This semester I'm taking a course called Issues in Religion and Literature, taught by Larry Bouchard, one of the last remaining professors with a job for the express purpose of teaching religion and literature here in the Religious Studies Department at UVA. He was a student of Nathan Scott, did his PhD at the University of Chicago back when religion and literature seemed to be a blossoming field with a bright future, and before it ran into various different problems, which we'll be learning about over the course of the semester. One of our assignments for the first class period is to read these four theses for religion and literature and their contraries that Bouchard has drawn up, and I think they'll make for a very interesting listening. He says, "These four theses are intended mainly to describe, for the sake of comparison and discussion, some rationales for the intentional study of religion and literature. When we look at specific occasions of such study, more than one thesis may apply. They may be mutually inclusive, and I consider them all valid and valuable. But their negations, the au contraire, as far as I am concerned, are not necessarily mutually consistent. They represent some very important, often postmodernist directions for criticizing religion and literature studies." Number one, literature and the arts, whether or not they address religious or spiritual traditions, can offer alternative, authoritative sources, for example, as distinct from scripture, philosophy, or the sciences, that disclose the human condition in respect to its depth or ultimacy. Such disclosures especially include negative aspects of human experience, its finitude, suffering, and proclivities toward evil, sin, or injustice. But the arts also may disclose ultimately comedic aspects of religious dimensionality, such as openness to sublimity or beauty, to divine immanence and transcendence, and to moral transformation. That's the thesis. And then his commentary. "This thesis has venerable antecedents from Neoplatonism to Romanticism and characterized the early work of Nathan Scott, who studied with theologians Paul Tillich and Reinhold Niebuhr, and others in mid-20th century religion and literary studies. It also reflects existentialism and neo-orthodox or dialectical theology, especially in such theology's exposure of structures of anxiety and sin in history and society, as well as individual existence. And the thesis offers ways to assert the theological importance of so-called secular works of art and literature, whether or not they intend to provoke religious readings. While such studies as Scott's were criticized for insinuating Christian apologetic interests upon literary works, see Sally McFeig, Literature and the Christian Life, 1966, the idea that literature reads well the human condition reasserts itself whenever new perspectives on said condition emerge, as in post-Holocaust discussions of the literature as testimony or in post-colonial pictures of life in societies other than Western. This thesis also relates to moral and political approaches to the arts in terms of the other or otherness, and it may relate to literary criticism and theory done from recent theological movements such as radical orthodoxy. That such approaches reflect the perspectives and interests of interpreters hardly seems avoidable, but rather something to evaluate." The au contraire is, "What works of art disclose is the absence of anything like the human condition. Art and literature are better at tracing the multifarious surfaces of life than plunging into its so-called depth. Criticism should resist any implication to grasp dimensions of life in art and literature, for such are invariably the sorts of ideologies that art merely repeats, or at best, disrupts." Number two, "Artistic forms and literary modes of discourse, by virtue of their sensual and organic qualities, their elusiveness and intertextuality, or their deployments of indeterminate ironies and tropes, for example, metaphor, metonymy, synecdoche, these artistic forms can express the inexpressible, that is, that in life which resists clear articulation. Hence, the limits of literary discourse may express, by indirection, limits associated with certain features of religious experience and language. That's the thesis, and then Bouchard's commentary. This thesis is similar to the first, but focuses more on language and form than on dimensions of experience. It also has roots in Romanticism, for example, to Coleridge's theories of symbol and imagination. Kierkegaard, indirect communication, and the late Heidegger, on art, language, and poetry. In Anglo-American literary studies, it reflects the new criticism, now very old. This was a movement that a number of religion and literature theorists defined themselves against, insofar as it purported to reject the relevance of extra-literary domains, for example, religion, for assessing autotelic works of literature, especially poems. But critics like Scott and Amos Wilder nonetheless came to adopt the new critical view that a literary work is a distinctive form that expresses what can ne'er so well, that can ne'er be so well expressed. Thesis 2 recurs as biblical scholars examine scripture in terms of poetry, metaphor, narrative, etc., and it relates to other fields interested in narrative, for example, medical, feminist, and communitarian ethics, for example, Martha Nussbaum. The thesis takes on new forms in religious and theological aesthetics, as when religious meanings are said to interact with how we experience aesthetic forms and assess tastes, Frank Birch Brown, or when linguistic limits are said to correlate with limit language and limit experiences in religion, such as Langdon Gilkey and David Tracy. The au contraire, then, is the linguistic or formal features of works of art, so designated only by convention, do not express indirectly or otherwise correlate with anything other than intertextuality, that is, with the plethora of language, imagery, material culture, etc. Thesis 2 can stand only if life is understood to be semiotic or textual all the way down, and only if distinctions as between artistic and ordinary, secular and religious, are seen to remain utterly arbitrary. Number 3. Literature and the arts are sources of religious knowledge because literary and art histories are coextensive with religious communities and histories, even providing their forms of expression, practice, interpretation, and transformation. Hence, study of religion entails study of the arts, and vice versa. Well, you'll see that that was my rationale for reading Cadman's Hymn, the previous episode, because it is a sort of liturgical piece that is coextensive with the very beginning of English literature. So, Bouchard comments, "Some may deplore or else be reassured by how old-fashioned this thesis seems. It harkens back to studies of allegory, iconography, religious themes, furtive Christ figures, or the piety or lack thereof of authors and artists. Others will view it, for better or worse, as limiting religion and art study to art that is intentionally religious or spiritual. Still others will be gladdened to land in something historically tangible and clearly apposite. Thesis 3 has a number of inestimable merits. 1. Not only do overt religious ideas, symbols, narratives, and practices have histories recognizable in art, but so do numerous other cultural matters that intersect religious traditions. Complex emotions, including those of enjoyment, forms of beauty, aesthetic tastes, ethical virtues and dispositions, instituted relations, for example, types of marriage, ways of producing and exchanging things and power, and modes or styles of human speech and interaction. For example, forms of address, etiquette, political systems, individual autonomy, gender and class stratification, rules of friendship and sexuality, valuations of compassion, patterns of suspicion and intolerance, etc. Histories of ethos, then, are traceable through all forms of cultural making. Thus, Thesis 3 combats the ahistoricism often associated with the first two theses. Merit number 2. This thesis views religion in cultural, linguistic, and historical terms, a la Clifford Geertz, and may make specifying what is religious in a work of art or literature less arbitrary. It should be noted, however, that when, with Geertz, we include broad notions of ethos, as well as beliefs and worldview, in religious as cultural traditions, it appears there will be no shortage of historical or modern works available for religious inquiry. For example, the title of Harold Pinter's play, Betrayal. I think what he means here is just that if religious means anything that that concerns ethos or beliefs or worldviews, then basically everything is going to be religious. And so you can examine the religion of any modern work of art, no matter how a-religious or anti-religious it is. Okay, merit number 3. Interpretation and transformation suggest that what is religiously interesting about a work of art is not merely its religio-cultural content, for example, an icon of Christ Pantocrator, an initiation ritual, a reference to karma, an attitude of devotion. What will be more interesting is how the traditional material is being transformed through the work's distinctive artistry. For example, the Pantocrator portrayed as a tattoo on Parker's back in the story by Flannery O'Connor. Such transformations may retrieve traditional elements as wholes, or as strands or fragments, or they may negate them. Such transformations may be variously critical or trusting of the traditions, and they may be deemed by various readers to be authentic or else idiosyncratically arbitrary. They may also be intentional or implicit, conscious or unconscious. They may be more or less obvious to the reader, viewer, auditor, or performer of the work. And those little binaries he has in bold. So he's constructing a grand typology, which is what the University of Chicago taught all of their students to do. And that's sort of what you had to do to write your dissertation and to sort of go out into the world and get your job. It's what Wesley Cort does in all of his books. And if it's done well, and Wesley Cort does it very well, it can really crack the nut wide open. Okay, merit number 4. You can tell he likes this, can't you? While Thesis 3 does not approach religious dimensions in art via the sacred, transcendence, ultimate concern, or the like, but rather locates them in proximity to historical traditions, it does not have to rule those approaches, but augments them. Let's read that again. While Thesis 3 does not approach religious dimensions in art via the sacred, transcendence, ultimate concern, or any concept like that, but rather locates them in proximity to historical traditions, therefore it does not have to rule those approaches, but augments them. I think he means does not have to rule out those approaches, but augments them. It does concern how existential or phenomenological views of religion and of art are historically contingent. It also suggests that what is experienced as religious is also encountered in reference to linguistic, historical, and otherwise culturally received forms that are necessarily interpretive in character and function. Now, finally, the au contraire. While Thesis 3 is so clever as to include its negations, the idea of interpretation and transformation is itself too much a principle of continuity. Rather, making art is very much a matter of self-assertion and resistance with respect to tradition. For example, Harold Bloom. While living within traditions, very much is very much a matter of social accommodation and survival, Emile Durkheim. So the only really important relationship between art and religion is antagonism. Number 4. Literature and art, on one hand, and religious traditions, on the other, may be viewed not only as modes of disclosure, expression, and historical entailment, but also as pluralistic modes of inquiry and criticism. I'll read that again. Literature and art, on the one hand, and religious traditions, on the other, may be viewed not only as modes of disclosure, expression, and historical entailment, but also as pluralistic modes of inquiry and criticism. So literary works may be viewed as inquiring into and criticizing whatever religious and moral concerns they happen to intersect. Likewise, religious traditions are found to have powerful resources for understanding and criticizing works of art, literature, and cultural making. Rather than only being an inverse relationship, the relationship can be one of mutual inquiry and critique. Bouchard's commentary. In addition to critique from Bloom's argument for antagonism, thesis 3 is often challenged in respect to 1. The ways traditions perpetuate structures of cognitive distortion and injustice, Jürgen Habermas, Judith Butler, and 2. The ways that a plurality of traditions and norms intersect our speaking and relating, for example, Mikhail Bakhtin and Jeffrey Stout. Understanding, it may be argued, is not secured by monolithic, univalent traditions. Tradition, however, is not necessarily viewed as innocent or monolithic in the third thesis. And this, the fourth thesis, implies that the religious significance of artworks may reside in their powers of critique. While thesis 4 is especially applicable to the history of the novel, it describes other genre families as well. Works can so employ their generic resources as to inquire into, say, the limits of symbolic systems, political economies, and moral orders. He cites Redfield and Nussbaum. They may engage in prophetic or iconoclastic suspicion of their own or other traditions, or of their own complicity in the very structures they expose or criticize. Furthermore, the blindness of a literary work demands that the critic be suspicious of the working of the literary artistic work itself. The au contraire to thesis 4 is that a work engages in inquiry. Does not inoculate it from blindness to the blinding effects of its own informing traditions and interests. Thesis 4 implicitly trades on an illusory notion of the critical self. It assumes that a work of art can be like a self-possessed self who can stand outside of itself and judge itself. While works, in conjunction with their audiences, do make critical judgments, such works are at best like thoroughly relational social selves. They can attain no position of insight that is not composed indeterminately of other positions and visions. They cannot, in other words, account for themselves as they try to account critically for others. Well, those are the four theses. They sound to me incredibly incisive and helpful, and maybe I'll have more from this class to read to you as the semester plays out.